Hello and welcome to AFPT Comics Podcast, the number one comics podcast on AFPTComics.com, coming at you with episode 103 FM. I'm your host, David Brook, and I'm here with Forrest Hollingsworth. Forrest, how you doing?
Oh, hey, Dave. Didn't see you there. Welcome to episode 103. This is a bad bit. We have so much going on. I'm doing okay. I'm excited to talk about comics. I'm excited to talk with our most podcastingest, appearingest guest.
Yes.
Zach Thompson, later in the episode, about his new project.
This will be his fifth time.
Five. That's a whole hand. A new horror, social commentary, sci-fi project, I Breathed a Body, coming next month from Aftershock.
Yes, indeed. That'll be exciting. Yeah, he's breaking records on this show with the most appearances.
Zach, I messaged once and told them, you have a standing invitation to just appear whenever you have a project.
Yeah.
And they've taken us up on it.
Yeah, no. Time.
So I'm quite happy with that. I'm flattered.
No, it's great. Yeah. I was actually just running numbers. We've had 54 different human beings on the show, and 12 of them have been on the show multiple times. So we've almost over half of our episodes have guests, apparently.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Hey, thanks for listening. Thanks for helping out. Stay tuned for more.
That's true. We're coming at you in 2021. We will actually be taking next week off, but we're going to be coming in hot in January with a best of 2020 list, like we always do. If you don't know, this is the comic book podcast where we recap the week in news, we review comics, and we look ahead to comics out next week, and of course have special segments and guests on to start every show. We recap the biggest news, and boy oh boy, DC and Marvel Comics have not released their solicitations for March yet, but they practically did this week because they revealed a ton of new creative teams as well as new books. Leading the charge over at the Hollywood Reporter on Friday, DC Comics revealed Infinite Frontier is a new era for DC Comics. Joshua Williamson is going to be spearheading this new era, but it is also a anthology book called Infinite Frontier Number Zero. That has a lot of creators like Jeff John, Scott Snyder, James Tynan, John Timms, Becky Cloonan. It's basically like a teaser of sorts for what comes after DC Future State.
Yeah, and some of these teams have, of course, already been announced. I mean, you have Tamaki on Detective Comics, Cloonan on Wonder Woman, some of those other teams, and this is kind of going to be the first foray into those stories.
Yeah.
And I think it will be the first time we get a really tenuous sense of how much of the future books will be informed by Future State.
Right.
How much of their marketing around, like, oh no, this is self-contained, it's only going to be 2 months, it's not going to have big effects. How true that is. Because DC certainly has a history of promoting that and then not holding themselves to it.
Right.
And given that a lot of the creative teams, or at least like the writer from Future State, is following up on the regularly scheduled book after that, it already makes me think not very much, but we will see.
Yeah, we will. Yeah. I don't know if they ever officially said Brian Michael Bendis and David Marquez are on Justice League, but this press release
all but confirmed.
Showed it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They also talk about the Joker series that Tynan's doing with Gilliam March.
Slightly less concerned about that one, I will say, than I was. Because I thought the original reveal, and I think very intentionally, was meant to make it seem like it was a book focused on the Joker or from the Joker's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Which, eye roll. Audible eye roll to that. But it's more like Gordon is trying to find the Joker, and his life is kind of threatened in the periphery.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that Joker is always a character who works better in the periphery anyway.
Right.
So I have less hesitations about that, despite, you know, kind of being tired of the Joker.
If the Joker's not in the mainline comics and he's only in this, that might make sense too. Like you said, like oversaturating the character could be so tiring.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, you know, the Joker is a character that will never go away, and it's one that a certain contingent of fans will want around all the time.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
but maybe this is a better home for it right now.
Sure. Probably the, I would say outside of that, the biggest news was that Philip Kennedy Johnson will be taking over Superman and Action Comics, taking away I mean, Brian Bendis has basically held court on that for, wow, how long has it been? 2 years? 3 years?
Yeah, well, two, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It just feels like forever.
Yeah.
No does. Offense, but if yeah, it's it. I think a lot of people are a little burned out on that, and they look forward to Johnson taking this over. He's joined with Phil Hester and Eric Grapster on Superman, and Scott Galuski and Daniel Semper on Action Comics. I think this is a good sign. Like, it shows that editorial is giving jobs to people who may not have the big splashy name as yet, but they will, and they've proven themselves across different publishers. And not only just indie scene, but also like at other publishers like Marvel or Image.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm starting to see a clearer idea of what the regular DC schedule is going to be, because they have continuously done a good job with Black Label and with Ink and Zoom. And also, you know, like Future State seems very well marketed, understood, contained, like we said to death at this point.
Yeah.
But it's a different thing to be like, what are the books going to look like bi-weekly or monthly?
Mm-hmm.
What is your mission statement for them?
Right, yeah.
And I think that, you know, keeping Tynion Tynan on Batman, moving Bendis away from Superman, getting new creators in there, and Johnson was quick to say this is a very short story
mm-hmm.
that requires both books, but I'm very excited to tell it. So there will be someone else after that, presumably. But, you know, they're kind of moving. It seems like they are taking a more full step into a new phase.
Right. Yeah. And I'm hoping these creators get a little longer than usual to hang on and tell their stories. You know, moving on to Tom Taylor and Bruno Redondo taking over Nightwing, when they took over Suicide Squad, people thought, oh, he'll be doing Suicide Squad for 50 issues, when in fact they had always planned for only 11 or 12 issues. I think it was 11.
Right. Yep.
So they don't ever want to reveal too much, because if Nightwing is selling a billion copies, they're not going to take them off it. That's the truth.
Right. Yeah. So a couple of anthology series here as well. Batman Urban Legends is a 64-page monthly anthology. They also announced another anthology series, Superman Red and Blue. I'm looking forward to both of these. You know, I like the anthology model. It's going to be more expensive to engage with. But I also think, like, sometimes it is better for a creator to just deliver the one-shot story that they want to,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to being like, okay, now I need to pad this into a mini.
Right.
Or, you know, something like that. And you can see those seams, as opposed to being spread thin.
It offers people who may not have an entire story arc to tell a story, and also younger, you know, up-and-coming creators to tell a story.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting. Like, I keep seeing people on Twitter in particular say, like, oh, anthologies don't sell. And I'm just thinking, have you seen what DC put out in 2020? There's like
they're more expensive and do sell.
Yeah. And there's like a new anthology at least every other week at DC Comics. Yeah.
Yep.
We already kind of talked about this, but yeah, the Joker number one is coming in March 2020 as well. And that's by James Tynion, who's also writing the Batman book. So he's a very busy dude. He's also got the Department of Truth, Wind. He's got so much going on. He's becoming the Brian Bendis of our era. Yeah. Razor Blades. Yeah, too. It also will have a backup by Sam Johns and Mirka Andolfo, which is going to carry forward the Punchline storyline that was featured in that one shot that she got. So if you like that character, you're going to get more of that.
Probably some Clown Hunter in there as well.
Yeah, probably. Last but not least from DC, a 6-issue Evil Justice League miniseries called Crime Syndicate is on the way. And there's also a backup by Brian Hitch that will feature the origin story of, what was his name? Ultraman.
Yeah. So I guess one thing that we're kind of talking around real quick I want to touch on is DC announced a whole schedule, a whole slew of backup stories.
Yes.
So you have smaller, more contained stories from names you know, like Ram V and stuff, that are going to be doing backup stories in all of their big titles, their flagship titles.
Mm-hmm.
I'm conflicted about that.
Mm.
You know, I'm very excited for some of them. I think, like, the unintended editorial voice that they're giving it, though, is like, oh, Ram V isn't... Justice League Dark is turning into a backup for Justice League, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives the unintended impression of like, oh, Ram V isn't ready for the main title,
mm-hmm.
when he very much is.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, And so I find it frustrating in that regard. Mm-hmm. But I will say we've talked before about, like, people will avoid anthology books that are specifically from marginalized voices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, people will go out of their way to not read Marvel's Voices and those kinds of things. And both you and I have been very vocal about those people need opportunities to get into the main books. And in that sense, I think that the backup may be a good way to do it. Because the content is already there for the reader to engage with.
It's also a way to slap another dollar on that book.
It is, yeah.
Because it's extra large. It's like a 30 or 34 page book instead of just 20.
Yeah, and I think it works out to like a dollar for every 8 pages or so in their model. So, I mean, it will be more expensive, but I also think that the value is there.
Yeah, one might argue that the $3.99 book may be out the window by end of 2021.
Yeah,
because every book's going to be $5.99 with the extra backup, and then eventually they'll just pull that backup out of the books, right? That's how capitalism works.
Them separately, yep. Yeah, you're right.
It's exciting. I don't think the DC solicitations are out yet, but they probably will be out next week along with Marvel, which we'll get to in a minute.
I mean, obviously, I'll cut slightly off the solicitation schedule because they wanted to drop a big thing going into the new year.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's weird. I was writing the AIPT newsletter. Totally sign up for that. It basically recaps the whole week of features and news, like the ones we're going over. And I was reflecting on how it's hard to reflect on 2020 when at the end of the month DC and Marvel are just dropping all these March news buds.
Yeah.
But moving on, before we get to Marvel, I want to talk a little bit about some indie news, one of which is going to blow your mind, as Rob Liefeld, your favorite artist and writer, is doing a series called Mighty Crusaders at Archie Comics. And in their press release, they make it very clear they are going to start pursuing more superhero tales, not just their, you know, Archie and Friends storylines. And they decided that Rob Liefeld is the perfect person to spearhead this, and he'll be taking on this Mighty Crusaders book, writing and drawing the book, I believe. I believe he's writing it. It didn't say specifically, but I assume so. But they revealed a preview, and it's everything you expect from Rob Liefeld.
Yeah, fuck this. I can't even get myself excited to dig into it or to bury it. Like, fuck this. He's going to be using art that he sketched out in the 80s.
Right, like, yeah.
It's nothing. It's a nothing story. It's a nothing line. It's a nothing launch. Archie has been struggling with getting books out on time or keeping some sort of tonal or creative consistency.
Yeah.
And, like, going to an admitted workhorse, but someone that has troubling for numerous reasons that we've talked about as Liefeld, it's just disappointing and frustrating. I just want you to get Afterlife out. I just want you to get Sabrina out. I don't want this.
It would have been smarter, in my opinion, if they had revealed not just Liefeld, but other creators doing the superhero thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's bad. It is bad PR in that regard, too.
The way it looks to me is like, hey, he sells comics. Let's see if they sell. And if they don't, well, it's done. We're not going to even try. Like, if they have nothing planned beyond Liefeld, it feels like, which is a bit odd.
Yeah.
I don't know. This isn't the first time they've tried to do superhero comics before. I don't know if anyone wants it. They're going to have to do a little bit more, I think, to gain our trust and interest. And I don't know if Rob Liefeld's the best to gain your trust.
No, I don't think so.
In some other indie comics, I don't know, is Boom Studios indie? I think it is.
I think, yeah. Yep.
They, out of nowhere, in my opinion, they dropped the news that Proctor Valley Road number 1 is coming out in 2021, and it's written by Grant Morrison and Alex Child, with art by Naomi Frank Quiz and colored by Tamara Bonvillain. So this is a sci-fi horror series. They revealed just cover art so far, so they probably are just still writing and drawing the first issue, but to see Grant Morrison on a new book is always kind of big news, I think, just because they don't do a lot, right? Like, they've got Green Lantern.
Yeah, and both of their books at DC are ending
in
the coming year. They're ending in March. And all of their collections for DC will be out in March. And so I don't think people really had a good idea of what was next for them.
Yeah, and Grant has like pointed out, like they might retire.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know if that means like I don't want to do work for the big two anymore. Or what that means. And I think they strike me as someone that is always going to be creating to some degree.
Probably.
But I don't know. This is not what I expected.
No.
A quick breakdown of Solicit says, August, Riley, Cora, and Jenny have organized a spook tour with their classmates on the most haunted, demon-infested stretch of road in America to fund attending the concert of their dreams. But when their visit turns deadly, these four friends race to rescue the missing students before the town tears them limb from limb. Now they must slay the evils roaming Proctor Valley Road along with the monsters lurking in the hearts of 1970s America. So I think that there's going to be a real weird pivot into making this a meta story.
Oh, okay.
About the kids on bicycles tropes.
Mm.
I mean, that's what I would expect from Morrison, right. I guess. Because this is very much the setup of, you know, Stranger Things, Stephen King type storytelling.
So it's a commentary on that, yeah.
But I don't think that that's coherent with the stories Morrison likes to tell, right?
It's also worth noting that, you know, in the press release, Morrison points out that they read Alex's original screenplay. So I think Morrison's probably acting as like a consultant.
Oh, that's, yeah.
To help convert it from screenplay to comic, right?
Yeah.
But you know, you never know. I mean, with Morrison on it, who knows? Could be hugely influential on how that book turns out. But I'm very interested. Just
absolutely.
Put Morrison's name on it. I want it.
Yeah.
Next in the news, Vault Comics all week teased new creative teams for 2021. Didn't say anything beyond who these creative teams are. Nothing about the books or
anything.
Do they need to
tell us anything besides the names to sell these books?
No, you're right.
Spurrier, Nathan Gooden, Peter Milligan,
yeah.
Ram V, Anad R.K., Adam Gorham, Christopher Cantwell, like, okay.
Yeah, I mean,
just tell me the title and where to pick it up.
It is a kind of a cool graphic, too. I like it. It's a smart way, I think, to just drum up a little interest while there's probably nothing drawn or written
yet. This is the opposite of the Rob Liefeld name drop.
Ooh, you're right, yeah.
Like, the Rob Liefeld name drop is like, okay, you didn't vet or you don't care.
Yes.
Like, this is going to be poor craftsmanship. I feel the opposite about this. Like, it's funny the gamut that you can have with marketing just names.
Sure, yeah.
And Morrison is that to a degree as well.
Yeah, I'm interested. I'm interested for sure. We'll see when they come out, though. It might not be till summer or even fall. Considering their sci-fi horror, it's probably going to be part of their horror indie or their horror label, I would say. My guess.
Mm-hmm.
Anywho, moving on. Marvel Comics revealed a few tidbits before they release their full solicitations next week. One of which is the Silk series is finally coming back. It was originally solicited for July, and now it's coming back in March. I saw a lot of folks on Twitter, on the APT Twitter, commenting and just being so excited for this. Silk character.
I like Silk. I think that initial run, that initial insert into the Spideyverse is like very frustrating for a number of reasons. But it's a character. She's a character that has a lot of opportunity and room for growth and, you know, a defining story, which I think a lot of the newer spider characters are still looking for a defining story.
Yeah.
I would say even Miles, like, his best stories are outside of comics.
Mm.
They're a video game and a movie.
Right. Especially since he's joined the 616.
Right. And they can't get rid of the Ultimate Verse. And that's kind of dragging that storytelling down. It's confusing. I would say the same for Spider-Gwen. Go Spider.
Yeah.
And so I think that what we need is someone that's just really focused on not tying these characters into the larger legacy of Peter Parker or into the larger legacy of what a Spider-Man or Spider-Verse story is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Think of that part after the fact.
Mm.
And write a story for these characters first.
Right.
Silk is especially difficult because she's a character completely defined by that legacy to date.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, her whole thing is the bride. Spider totems. Like, we could talk about that for hours. Man, we should drop a spider story sometime.
Remember when Peter was like horny for her?
Yes. Yeah. When her original costume was just webs
that were
torn up all the time.
Yeah.
So 90s. Like, it's going to take a lot of work to step away from that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like you said about the responses on Twitter, people want that for her.
Especially, I think, because she's an Asian character.
Yes.
You see that with Agents of Atlas, too. I there's a lot of people that are just super fans of this stuff that I wasn't aware of until, like, I saw the reaction on Twitter, which is great.
Yeah. But and you know, art more by representation. Takeshi Miyazawa, too. Like, it's a good creative team that they have attached to it.
Yeah.
But I have very conflicted feelings about this, the larger Spider-Verse in general.
Right.
And so I hope that this is good.
We know that the Mariko Tamaki and Gohiru team-up book Thor and Loki Double Trouble will be fun.
Can I tell you how weirdly excited I am for this? That Spider-Man and Venom Double Trouble book was really good.
So fun. Just like light and like anybody can enjoy it.
Yeah, Tamaki is, you know, one of my favorite writers working today. I'm very excited for her run to start on Detective Comics. I love all of her indie projects. I love how she straddles the line between very serious, in-depth storytelling and this kind of lighter, breezy, funny, engaging storytelling. And, you know, Harley Quinn Breaking Glass is all of that in one place.
Yeah, it is.
If you're looking for somewhere to start. I had to get a Secret Santa gift for someone recently, and I got them a bunch of Tamaki books.
Nice.
So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, we could go back to our gift guide, and we should just add, you know, all Mariko Tamaki books.
Yeah.
At this point, it is interesting to me that Double Trouble is becoming like a series. I wonder, who do you suppose after Thor and Loki, Tamaki and Gerhu will do? Who could it be? Who's a good duo?
Huh?
Maybe X-Men, like Cyclops and Jean or something.
Oh yeah, you could do something like that. Yeah, I like the Krakoa Age makes that a little weird. Maybe
it does. Yeah, it would be hard to fit in.
Yeah,
probably the biggest. Reveals that we haven't talked about yet. Daniel Warren Johnson is taking on Beta Ray Bill.
Yes.
This is spinning out of King in Black. I don't know exactly how that works, but there is on the cover art the little spinny forehead thing
that
Null has on the symbiotes.
I'm so excited for this.
It's going to be
another character, another creator where I would say just pick up anything that they've done.
For sure.
Like, and you'll be happy. You'll be satisfied. Murder Falcon, in particular, is really fantastic. Extremity, I liked a whole lot as well.
Mm-hmm.
Warren Johnson's art is amazing. It's so detailed and heavy metal and dense and rich. And so it's so kinetic. Like, the way he draws people moving and the action scenes and stuff, like, are so immediately satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just the perfect title for him. Weird cosmic stuff mixed with the high flying action, heavy punched stuff that Beta Ray Bill or any character adjacent to Thor should be trading in. Like, it's just a lot. It's just a lot of good things in a row.
When I saw this news, I immediately thought, did someone at Marvel see Wonder Woman Dead Earth and go, holy shit, we need that?
Yeah.
Let's do that. Let's do six issues of that, but with one of ours. I mean, it's pretty cool. I bet you he got a bit of a raise for it after his Wonder Woman work, because that book was crazy good, too.
Yeah, that's a high-profile book. We will be talking about that book in a couple of weeks.
Bum, bum, bum. In the last bit of news, Steve Orlando is set for Man-Thing. It'll be a new three-issue arc, but it'll be the first of a trilogy focusing on Man-Thing. Was there an artist listed? I don't think there was, but this is coming in March.
I saw one. Yeah, I did see some variant covers. Including, like, a Venomized Man-Thing.
Oh, yeah. It's called Avengers Curse of the Man-Thing. But, okay, I don't know if you've read Martian Manhunter by Steve Orlando. Did you, Forrest? you'll probably love this, because this is the kind of character that could use that, you know, brooding, internal monologuing, identity searching kind of thing. This is a strange creature that has never, I mean, I can't say never, but has never really, in a modern time, been explored that deeply.
No, there was a R.L. Stein written miniseries.
I don't want to bring that one up.
And like, it was, that book is very, very interesting in its own regard.
Sure.
But it's not a book that would make you want to read more Man-Thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Orlando is maybe one of the better creators to make a statement about why you would want to read a Man-Thing story.
Oh, here it is. Francesco Mobili will be doing the art, and Carmen Carnero did some of the character design.
Okay, all right, yeah.
Fashion design.
Yeah, I'm around. I'm available. Let me know.
It looks cool. I'm excited. Moving on to our top books of the week, our next segment, we're going to talk about our top two favorite comics out this week. Forrest, what's your second favorite book out last week?
So my second favorite book out was the anthology series Wolverine Black, White, and Blood number 2. There's a lot of folks on this, including Chris Claremont, Vida Ayala, Saladin Ahmed, Salvador LaRocca. I'm trying to think of them off the top of my head. Kev Walker, Greg Land, quite a few names attached to it. I will say the same as I said for the first issue, that I don't think that the stories are the strongest thing here.
Right.
The art is really, really singularly fantastic, though. It's really fun to see these creators narrow in on the kind of, like, immediate, brash, high-paced violence that Wolverine is good for. Mm-hmm. And I think it's even strengthened by the kind of, like, gory noir look of just having black, white, and red. This book feels very structurally different from the Harley Quinn ones.
Oh, for sure.
And that's because you're going between a lot of stories more quickly, as opposed to the Harley Quinn one being, like, an entire issue dedicated to one story. And those were also in a digital format. But I think, like, it's evocative and it's interesting, and it does make a good case for anthology storytelling, I think. Because there wasn't a single story here that I was like, I'd like to see more of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see this, you know, spread into a miniseries or anything like that.
Oh, yeah. I want to see where the story goes from here, yeah.
But I did think, like, yeah, as a snapshot into Wolverine's life, or really just as a means to do really badass art, this works.
Yeah, I reviewed it for AAPT, and it feels like each story is just an action scene, pretty much, with a little follow-up.
I mean, it's really just a vehicle for the art.
Right, and for that, you know, it does a good job. If your expectations are set for, I want to see some blood splatter, then you're good to go.
Yeah.
Although, you know, it's like Greg Land's art, you just see all the faces you've seen 100 times by him, and it's like,
they've got LaRocca around as well, and yep. That's, you know. But yeah, I think that there's some good work here.
My second favorite book of the week was New Mutants number 14 by Vida Ayala and Rod Rice. This is the first book Ayala and Rice are kicking off, and in this new story arc, post, I guess this is part of Reign of X. They haven't officially said, but it's definitely post Ten of Swords. This is one of the most X-Men-y X-Men comics in the new era I've ever read. It focuses on character a lot more than a lot of the other arcs have. And I'm talking a lot of character. There's many, many characters in here that get moments in the sun, you know, from Magic to Moonstar. And there is a younger set of characters that pop in. I don't want to spoil it at all because it's a very dense and rich and entertaining read because it's so good at character. And by the end, you want to read more about these characters because they are, you know, lesser seen in most of the books so far since Hickman's reboot. And Rod Rice's art is just spectacular. Yeah. I keep thinking of Bill Sienkiewicz sometimes on some of these pages.
Oh, I think it's very intentionally channeling, you know, stuff like the Demon Bear Saga.
Right, like the cat.
Yeah, it's very much in that vein. I think I would say normally it's very weird to reboot or renegotiate what a book is about at the 14th issue.
It is a little odd.
But
yeah.
Like, Rice is such a good foundation for the art that I understand why they did that.
Right, yeah, because he's dipped in mostly. I think he only did Hickman written issues, right? And then Brisson's.
I don't think that's the case. I think he did some of the Brisson ones.
He did?
Yeah.
But totally read this. It's a great jumping on point, too. So I would recommend jumping in. If you haven't jumped into New Mutants yet, this is a good place to start. You can tell there's a strong foundational story set to push forward.
Mm-hmm.
What is your favorite comic of the week, sir?
So I'm going to preface this by saying this book is very hard to talk about without spoiling it.
Okay, yeah.
And so I'm going to be very curt, I guess. Ooh.
Okay.
My favorite book of the week is King in Black, Immortal Hulk. This is a one-shot tie-in to King in Black, written by Al Ewing, with art by Aaron Cooter. It is a silent book, meaning there's no dialogue. It does a really, really fantastic, heartbreaking job of tying together the Immortal Hulk narrative elements with the overarching King in Black kind of invasion horror storytelling. And meeting the existential emotive dread that Immortal Hulk is married to with this kind of like goofy big sci-fi story, invasion story that King in Black is very, very difficult to do, I think. But they did a really, really good job. Mm. It is sad.
Mm-hmm.
It's like one of the saddest issues I've read all year. Looked at all year.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Al Ewing has a very rarefied position as being someone who writes a one shot that is better than an entire event.
It is deeply meaningful. Yeah,
this continues the trend.
Cooter's ability to draw Hulk looking, you can commiserate with the character, but also he's like freakish in some of the shots and scary, yeah, disturbing, yeah. But also this is like a version of Hulk that's not like super huge. He's very like thin and childlike. Mm-hmm. And he captures he's those gaunt elements.
Yeah he's got this awe in his eyes. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene, there's maybe a little bit of a wonky panel early on where he like opens his eyes and his mouth in surprise.
Yeah, and he's and like, I was like, silly looking.
This looks bad, but also like in a way that's like disarming. And I was like, right. You know, I think that's what they were going for.
Right.
How solid the rest of the art is.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah, it's a cool book.
It's great.
It's always exciting when there's no dialogue or captions because you're like, oh, how are they going to pull this off?
Yeah. Yep.
My favorite comic book of the week was Black Cat number 1 by Jed McKay and C.F. Villa. This is a King in Black tie-in as well. It is also the reboot of sorts of Black Cat under McKay. And I think it's just an exceptionally well-done hero story for a typically non-hero type character like Black Cat. She's had her moments in the sun where she's straight hero, but here she still is trying to steal stuff with her crew from the previous story arcs that McKay had written. But there is a powerful moment. This isn't too much of a spoiler because it's so early on, where the Null has attacked Earth and she's taken off guard. She was in the middle of a heist, and lo and behold, there's Captain America. And what she's thinking in the captions about how, you know, everything is true about him, about how he fights for what, you know, what matters and what we should believe in. And he sees the good in others. And there's like a moment where she's like, oh God, he's going to think ill of me or whatever because of my past and, you know, what I'm usually up to. And it's not that case. He actually looks at her and knows that she can help. And it's like a very heartwarming moment that kind of solidifies the fact that Black Cat is a good person to her core.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it all sets up a mega heist, another mega heist, because that's what this book's all about. And that's why it's so fun, which I won't spoil, but it will tie into King in Black just enough. But I think it's on its own terms, so it won't be like necessary reading if you don't want to read it. And you don't have to read King in Black either to enjoy it as well. So
it's pretty fascinating. I think that the takeaway from King in Black is going to be that the tie-ins were better.
So many of them are like,
main
how
event?
Does this even like tie into the main event? Like, it's just its own thing.
Oh,
like,
there
like
was
the
like
Kaiju
a Namor
one.
Book, a Namor book that like had nothing to do with it.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, like, it was all his like flashbacks when he was like a teenager.
Yeah, so I don't know. It's kind of like they're putting all of this stuff under that title just because Venom is selling really well.
Yeah, you're right.
But
yeah,
like, I would say to readers, like, don't be dissuaded by that title treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Because Black Cat and quite a few other books, and even really that Immortal Hulk one, like, they don't have very much to do with King in Black at all.
No, not really. I mean, it's going to be like that little like detail, like, oh, because Black Cat did this, we got a little bit more of an edge.
Right.
But yeah, check out Black Cat. It's a solid book. And it was a solid book before, too. It was unfortunate that it had to be canceled of sorts.
Yeah. Mackey is a really, really good, solid writer. Mm-hmm. And one that I think, like, Black Cat's not a character that I want to read week to week, but, like, you're making a good case for it. Kind of the same I feel about Orlando doing Man-Thing.
Sure, yeah, Man-Thing, that's a tough one to pull off, period.
Yeah.
But I think Orlando can do it. Moving on to our next segment, top books for next week. We're going to talk about the number one book we're looking forward to next week, and oh my god, we picked the same book.
We did. There's not a whole lot out next week.
There isn't, no.
And as a reminder, we won't have a show next week.
Oh, that's true. So yeah, we both picked King Size Conan.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, like, hey, this episode seems to be all about the anthology series.
Apparently.
Why not? Yeah. Conan is already a character that is like, a lot of the time they just drop you into the deep end of a story or in media res.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not ever really about the overarching narrative. And I think that that's kind of why Aaron's story started to fall apart.
Right.
And I think that they've got creators like Kurt Busiek tied to this. Like, they know what they're doing. They've written Conan before. It's just a really, really, really great vehicle for weird stories outside of the norm for Marvel, and a lot of artists too.
You know, it's funny to think when Marvel took over Conan, we started this podcast, and I remember early on, like the first few months of this show, you and I would gush over Conan over and over. And then it started to taper off when Conan started having adventures with Wolverine and Venom.
Yeah, you know, I worry that they're going to do the same thing with Alien.
Yeah, me too.
But, like, there's still a very strong case to be made for Conan stories and what they do. And I think the immediate differences between him and Wolverine, even, mm-hmm. as a character. Like, I think that if you read Black, White, and Blood this week, and then you read King Size Conan next week...
Yeah.
They would feel very, very different, despite people saying, like, oh, you could interchange them or you could use either character to tell those stories. You couldn't.
No. Yeah, I actually already reviewed it. It's going up on Monday.
Oh, nice.
I'm giving it a 10 out of 10. So
okay.
I'm not going to spoil anything, but I will say three things. One, Kurt Busiek and Roy Thomas's stories actually tie into very important, historically important Conan stories that were originally at Dark Horse and at Marvel. That's great. All these stories are just like an ode to the character before he joined Marvel. So like it all feels like those classic great versions of the character you love, like the pirate Conan or the Conan who's at war.
They're I'm all sorry, depicted I just think well that's here. So funny that they were like, oh shit, we need to back up.
It feels that way, yeah. It feels like they were like, let's get back to what makes this character good.
It feels like a relaunch.
In a way, yeah. And I have to say, Chris Claremont, who I'm not a huge fan of, his story with art by Roberto de la Torre is really good. It's just super good. And, you know, because I think he writes in an older style, you could say, it fits this character. Because when you're reading the story, it feels like it's like a story that was lost in time that's been recovered. So again, it gives you those like warm and fuzzies of like the Conan you loved from the 90s has returned. So yeah, and the art is just insane across the entire book. Yeah, totally check that out. I think it is, how much is it? It's $7, but it is like 54 pages, I think.
Yeah, all right. I mean, that's okay.
If you read this and go, I want that. Maybe if everyone buys it, we'll get traditional Conan stories again. Although I know Jim Zub is writing those. In the main Conan book.
Yeah.
Any Hoosiers, in our next segment, Zach Thompson's going to be joining us to talk about I Breathe the Body, which comes out January 20th from Aftershock with art by Andy McDonald. Enjoy, and we'll see you in 2021, or you'll hear us in 2021.
Wear your mask.
Indeed.
Stay home for Christmas.
Yeah, do that too.
I know that sucks to hear, but you stay home, mail your family your gifts, meet up on Zoom, do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Take care of each other.
Be kind to one another, for sure.
Look out for each other and, you know, be conscious about what this time of year means and why it needs to be different this year as well.
So I'm with us is Zach Thompson for the fifth time, and you've got plenty of business going on in 2021. You've got I Breathe the Body coming out January 20th. With art by Andy McDonald at Aftershock. You've got Lonely Receiver number 5 coming out January 13th with Jen Hickman. And then Undone by Blood is getting its follow-up in March. How you doing, Zach? And are you tired?
I'm doing great, and I feel like everyone is tired this year. It's a weird thing to be at the end of 2020 and feel like last month was March and now it's December.
Right, yeah. It just zipped by, didn't it?
Yeah, it really did.
So with I Breathe the Body, we're going to talk about mostly that, I think, today. But it mixes... body horror, societal horror, and this intense lack of empathy and humanity as we peer into this social media dynamic and see how terrible things have gotten. I suspect the first issue is a condensed version of the original idea, but where did this all start and how did we get to the final issue set for release?
So years ago, I worked, I don't think I should name them. I worked for a large journalism outlet based in New York. I was one of their few sort of Canadian staff. And part of my job was to be a video producer with influencers. So we were going to YouTube and trying to do social justice motivated pieces. And my first day on the job was the day of the Pulse nightclub shooting.
Wow.
And so, like, it was a real trial by fire, sort of got thrown in, and I sort of realized the reality of how fast these things move, but I also realized how inept influencers are at sort of actually dealing with any real level of, like, empathy or, and, like, some of them are amazing. I should say that first and foremost, because I worked with some people that were legitimately incredible human beings who are more generous than they had any reason to be. But this is all to say, after working there for a little while, we were dealing with working with Jake Paul or his brother Logan Paul. I forget which one. Mm-hmm. The one that filmed the dead body in the suicide forest.
Logan.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there was
I know that.
Yeah. He's they've like amalgamated into one being in my head because they both just, I hate them both.
Right, sure.
So we were like flirting with bringing him in and having him do content. And the deal was almost done. And then on the day that he filmed the dead body, we had like a staff meeting. And I sat in a room and watched all of my upper level management sort of like rationalize why it was okay for this person to film a dead body and put it on YouTube. And it quickly became clear to me that I was like, I need to get the fuck out of this job. And this is like very morally bankrupt. And it's just not like, it just sort of things kind of clicked into place. And this idea has been in my head since like January, 2017.
I could see how that would inspire something like that. That is just awful.
So I, as a quick follow-up to that, is it a little bit of a cathartic process to get your thoughts out about stuff like this?
Yeah, I mean, like, I try really hard to, when I'm doing horror in particular, to have something that I have, like, an emotional relationship with, something that, like, I want to say. And I think, in particular, with this year, because it's about the voyeurism of violence on social media and sort of like the people who sort of engineer that type of content. You know, it's no secret that this year in particular, we've seen a lot of trauma put online. A lot of people who, you know, feel like the institutions that were supposed to sort of lift us up and keep society together have kind of failed in big, broad ways. And unfortunately, people are going to social media to sort of like communicate that failure, and mm-hmm. it feels like more sort of like apt than ever to sort of like look at why we're in these cycles. And like, you know, for example, like we talk about, we want Facebook or Twitter to control free speech so badly, and we want them to remove certain types of content. But like, you know, if you really think about that and follow it to its logical extent, that gives Facebook more power, right? That gives Twitter more power to decide what's right and what's not right. And then that doesn't make them go away. That makes them like part of the fabric of society in a way that you cannot undo. And that's scary in and of itself.
You know, moving on from like the social media aspect of the book, there are these there's an intense visual pop to both issue one and two. And I was curious, in what detail do you get to, you know, explicitly lay out these visual ideas, and where does Andy McDonald come in with that, with their own vision to sort of put their spin on some of these things?
So I write like probably Alan Moore level detail scripts sometimes on certain things because I have a certain idea for a visual and I'm not married to it in any way, shape or form. I try to like communicate, like there's a splash in issue two early on that like I knew what that was going to be and I knew exactly how that was going to look, and I really had all these like reference photos for what I wanted to look like, and I gave all that to Andy and he changed it slightly because of like who he is and what he brought to it. But it's a lot of like that amalgamation where I go like, hey, here's all this crazy shit I've been looking at, here's sort of the tone of what I want to communicate. And like, you do what you think is best to sort of like marry that with what I've got. But I try to really create a strong sort of like safety net and support system for the visual. So it's like, even if it's not exactly what ends up being on the page, there's so much reference material and thought put behind it that like Andy at least knows what I'm trying to communicate and then can sort of take it and spin it in his own direction. But it's a lot of back and forth right down to like when he sends in thumbs, you know, I'm like, okay, cool. But what if we change this angle a little bit here? Or what if we tilted this? Or what if we put this like element in the foreground here to really communicate like the subtext of this thing or whatever. And it's a lot of like, I really am heavily involved and I don't know if everyone else is, but I really like just to sort of like get my hands dirty. And I feel like that communication leads to a better book because you're talking to one another.
Right. Just more collaboration.
Yeah. And it's never like, it has to be this way. It's just like, hey, I just wanted you to know, I was thinking about it this way and this is what I was trying to communicate. And I think that's awesome. And I think if you tweak this or tweak that, we might even get that better. And then they might be like, oh, actually, you know what? I don't think we should do that. We should do this. And I go, oh, yeah, wow. And then just sort of like, that's the magic of it all, right? Is that like collaborative building.
Right.
So there's kind of an unspoken element that I want to follow up on there, which is that a lot of the time, something we don't talk about is that the writer needs to pitch their collaborators on a project. When you're writing an idea or starting the early drafts of a script, do you have a specific artist in mind? Or is that, in this case, was that something that was facilitated by Aftershock?
So this is an interesting project in that, like, I submitted the outline for this, like, right at the end of Lonely Receiver. And I was like, this is what I want to do next. And at that time, I was like, I want to do something with someone who's different than Jen, something that is like more visceral and has, because there's a visceral quality to the book.
Is there so ever?
And so I was like, you know, I want something that with the texture and the detail. And I communicated that to Mike Martz, who's the editor in chief at Aftershock. And he was like, yeah, like I can definitely see that, like those darker sort of heavier inks, that kind of thing. And he's like, you know what? Andy McDonald just emailed me yesterday and said, like, you know, he would really like to work together. Do you want me to see if he could come on the book? And I was like, you know, I'm a big fan of Andy's, had read Multiple Man and saw what he could do. And I was like, if Andy can come onto this book, like, oh my God. And so like, I didn't even write the first issue before Andy came on board. And then we were able to like, without getting too far into like spoiler territory, because you know, like it has similar elements to Lonely Receiver. So like I was able to like sync up with him and be like, I want to have like flying bug phones in this book. let's build those things out. And like, so we were able to like really world build in the early stages because he came onto the project so early and he was so down to just kind of like run with it. Which, you know, I realize that sometimes the stuff that I put forward requires a lot of world building, a lot of work. And not everyone's down to sort of like collaborate on that level.
Sure.
It's funny you bring up the phone, cause that was one of my questions a little bit later on, but I'm going to bring it up now. Like the fact that the phones in Lonely Receiver and this are not shaped like phones we have today. I have to ask you, what would your futuristic phone be in the shape of?
Well, I really like the ones in I Breathe the Body. I thought that was like cool. And I love the idea of like the bug wings being able to like fly up and sort of like record your face as you're like doing like a selfie video. But this all comes from me really thinking that like technology is a little bit more alive than we give it credit. And, you know, it watches us, it listens to us, all that kind of stuff. And so for me, I'm always like fantasizing, I guess, about the idea of like this little like living buddy that like whatever it's going to become is going to become this thing that will like respond to your beck and call like Siri, but taken to the next logical extent.
Like BB-8 or something?
Yeah, sure. And like that's sort of exciting to me. It's also like terrifying because it shows up in a lot of my horror work. But I think there's like, there's something coming that I think we're not entirely ready for that will radically change the way we use technology.
So can I put you down for the shape of a banana?
Sure. Yeah. or you know, like I'm preferable to the ball sack ones in Lonely Receiver too.
Okay, let's do that. I'm gonna put that.
We just need to fill out the form, Zach. I don't know. So can you tell us a little bit about, you said you had a lot of reference material ready. What media outside of comics, books, movies, games, whatever, inspired I Breathe the Body?
So, I mean, it comes from a lifelong love for Clive Barker. And I think one of the things that Clive Barker did really well is a lot of his work deals with duality. The duality of like, or the razor thin line between like, you know, sexual pleasure or sexual perversion. And that's some stuff that's sort of, again, in Lonely Receiver and some of my other work. But I love that sort of like complex, playful nature of like, you know, you can be like evil and good can be like right on this razor thin line. And so I really wanted to create a book that was like evocative of Barker's best stuff, but set in the future. And then apart from all of that, I've been reading a ton of weird fiction. You know, like Yoko Ogawa's The Memory Police, Augustina Batstarica, I probably butchered her name, Tender is the Flesh, Hong Kang's The Vegetarian, a lot of stuff that sort of like deals with worlds that are just sort of left of reality.
Mm. Sure.
They're skewed just slightly. So, and that's for a number of reasons I'm drawn to that. But I think for the stuff that I want to write, I kept seeing this thing where I'm like, okay, for example, like this book is about social media companies. It's about influencers, all that other stuff. But if I was mentioning Facebook or Instagram or Logan Paul or whatever on every two or three pages, people have already made up their minds about all of that stuff. They have feelings about it. They're not inherently interesting because we deal with that shit every fucking day and it's exhausting. And it creates this sense of like, I really think you just don't want to engage with material like that unless you're very interested in it. And I don't want to necessarily remind people of the things that exhaust them in the real world. What I want to do is create worlds that sort of have the texture and the elements that evoke certain things in our world, but stand in for them. And then by virtue of that, you're compelled to sort of like learn more about it and interrogate it because you're like, this is similar to that, but not quite. And I sort of want to find out more about it. Those are the stories that have kind of drawn me in over the last year. And maybe that's like driven from reality being at an all-time the all-time worst.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like, also, I think there's just a lot of power in that. I think that like when you're speaking about modern issues, the moment you sort of show people on iPhones or doing modern things, you sort of like you rob a comic of its visual texture because you know, I don't read comics to see imagery that I see every day. I read comics to see imagery that's fantastic and weird and has this like element of like an alternate reality, so to speak.
Yeah, I would say that your work trades a lot in psychic suggestion through explicitness. And there's a very definite channeling of that into I Breathe the Body and in a different way into Lonely Receiver. And I just wanted to take the time to commend you on that. When I step away from reading one of your books, and I often do advanced copies digital, and then I'm like, well, I want to engage with this, and I go and get the physical copy. And I will say, I keep thinking about them. I appreciate that very much. They're sticky.
And I tried to do that on purpose where like, I think that's something that I learned from Cronenberg because a lot of Cronenberg's work is sort of set in reality, but it's not quite reality. And that's the thing is like, you know, when this book was approved, for example, I'm a little tricky in the way that I pitch stuff sometimes. So I pitch this as like a full on YouTuber in the modern day sort of like, you know, just like in reality as we know it. And what happened was Lonely Receiver was coming out, and I was really nervous about the like weird fiction-y elements of Lonely Receiver. And then that's what people ended up responding to quite a bit. And so it actually made me kind of take a step back and go like, am I doing myself a disservice by setting this story in reality? What do I gain and what do I lose from sort of going into that like weird alternate future? And then I was just like, fuck it, that's me. I'm going all the way into the weird.
It's interesting to me you brought up Clive Barker. I was a big fan of his comic Next Testament. And yeah, the visual style in that reminds me of A Breed the Body, and that there's like this darkness kind of everywhere. There's the way of inking, but also the story structure and like not structure, but so much as like what the content in it that is so haunting. Were you a fan of Next Testament?
Yeah. So I actually have those like on my desk, like beside me right now. So yes, I got them for Christmas like a couple of years ago, and I think it's the only original story he did in comics.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. It's really cool. Yeah. The fact that it's getting under my skin, A Breed the Body is getting under my skin like that is just so cool, because you don't see that very often.
Hell yeah.
So now you've launched a high number of projects this year, particularly. How do you keep your ideas organized, and how do you decide what buds are worth fertilizing?
That's a great question. So part of what happened this year was like things sort of got backlogged in a way that like created this like, you know, with the Diamond distribution sort of disruption and everything, things kind of got all shuffled around. So like realistically, like this book shouldn't have come so close on the heels of Lonely Receiver, but because of the way things happened, because like Lonely Receiver was originally supposed to come out in May. It would have been finished in September, and then this one was still probably going to come out in January, but because of everything sort of all kind of collapsed upon itself. But I work ahead. That's part of it. So like, for example, I'm done writing I Breathe the Body. I try to finish my miniseries before the first issue comes out, partly because there's a complexity to the sort of stories I want to tell and create our own books that requires me to stay ahead, simply because when the time comes to lock the first issue, I feel like I really need to know where my ending is and where I'm going. So everything sort of like feels like it's very interlocked and ready to pay off, because there is a level of complexity to it that like, if I don't wrap my head around my ending, then I'm screwed. And that's only come from really just being able to like grind into a work schedule where like I write usually 4 books at once and 1 book a week. So like I'll do like week 1 will be my No One's Rose week, and then I'll write a script, and then like week 2 will be my Undone by Blood week. I'll write a script, and sort of like those have rolling sort of like timelines to them. So like I'll write the script, but I maybe will edit it the next week while I'm writing something else. The idea is to sort of keep weeks sort of like purely focused on one type of thinking and one type of content. And this is definitely something I stole from Jeff Lemire. He posted about like how he writes multiple books at once and how he's sort of wrapped his head around it. And I feel like that's part of like when you're in comics and you're working quickly, you get to a point where you are writing 3 or 4 things at once, and you sort of have to like be able to like just separate the wildly different thoughts from one another. And like, I really try to make my work also very different. That's another thing, is like kind of like, you know, like a Western, like a hard-edged sci-fi solar punk book, a romance horror, and then like a full-on supernatural tech thriller thing. And so they don't really cross-pollinate with one another, which is nice because it kind of like allows me to keep my head clear. But I wish I had a better answer than that, other than I'm just very organized.
Do you change your physical space at all?
Sometimes I change my physical space when I'm outlining. I find that like I usually outline in bed, oddly enough, because that, like, I'll, like, be reading and sort of, like, I take, like, a stack of books with me and I take my computer and I just kind of, like, spread out and sort of, like, idea generate. And so I was talking about this somewhere else, but, like, sometimes when I'm writing a first draft outline for a series, like, it will come in at, like, 30 or 40 pages. And it's, like, sometimes it's, like, 8 pages of that is just straight up dialogue that I'm like, I don't know where this goes, but this is some stuff that I want to be said in the context of the narrative somewhere. And then it becomes like this crazy sort of like trying to like extract all of this information from this like river of consciousness, and spread it out over 5 issues or whatever. But I have a very rigid structure for like outlining and scripting. So like I've just like beat that into my head and it sort of works the same way every time. And it allows me to sort of have these like tools that are really process driven. So like, I don't really fuck around with the way that I do things. I do it the same way every time on every book.
Was there anything in I Breathe the Body in particular that you felt was really kind of pushing your limits as a creator?
Okay. So, I mean, there's some stuff that is not in the early issues, but like, a lot of the visceral stuff, I've written a handful of horror books and I don't usually deal in gratuitous violence. And so like one of the things I was intrigued by is like doing that here. But in doing so, it kind of made me sick and uncomfortable. And like, you know, it only gets worse, unfortunately. And then like, my other books, I look at creator-owned books as sort of this ability to experiment. And what I've sort of realized about myself is that, like, I really think there's an opportunity to get more playful with the way that people engage with stories. And so, like, you can see that in Undone by Blood, where there's, like, the dual narrative, but, like, you know, one's very prose-heavy, and then one has absolutely no voiceover at all. It's very streamlined and sort of like all told visually. Lonely Receiver builds towards a place where like the last issue is all written in second person narration. Did that on purpose to sort of like try to like step outside of what I was comfortable with and do something different. And then with I Breathe the Body, there's something coming in the 4th and 5th issue that sort of shift the narrative a little bit and get more experimental and playful. And again, it was something that I was like, I have not really seen people do this in comics for, you know, in North American comics, I should say, for, you know, 30 years or so. So why don't I fuck with it and see what I can do? And like, I don't know if it will be a success or not, but I think the thing that I'm proud of is that it made me step outside of where I was comfortable and push myself to a place where like it has this like playful, reflexive nature that also is related to the themes of the book and is also sort of like, when you're invested that far into the book, that you're going to, I hope, find that rewarding and interesting, and it's going to compel you to want to go further. Because I feel like there's this idea of like miniseries in particular, you know, everyone reads the first issue, half that read the second, and then so on as you go forward.
Yeah.
And so my mindset is like, those who stick around make it extremely rewarding for those folks who keep reading the book for 2 reasons. One, they're following you into hell. And then two, if you do these playful things, you also like hopefully get people excited and get them to talk to one another and get them to feel like they spent their money on something that was worth it because they were surprised by what you were doing. And like, there was a very conscious choice with Lonely Receiver to like rip the rug out from under you every time an issue was over. So when you think you know where it's going, you don't. And like, I Breathe the Body is pretty steady in one direction until the end of the 3rd issue. And then the 4th just goes, sorry, things are about to change. And I'm having a lot of fun with doing that kind of thing lately.
Did I Breathe a Body require any specific or special research?
Yeah. So, I mean, like, I looked a lot into, like, how decentralized networks work because I thought, you know, I want this to be different from other books about the internet, and that, like, I also wanted to just, like, teach people about certain things that are around or certain technological breakthroughs that are just sort of at the periphery of, like, maybe changing the way that we live. But on top of that, as the series progresses, it gets more into mushroom horror. Or
right. I was going to say, we can't not talk about mycology.
Yeah. And so, like, that was a huge thing. It sort of was this, like, happy accident because, like, I was getting into mushrooms and mycology at the end of No One's Rose, because there's, like, a fungal-based city in that book. And kind of what happened is Emily and I had been talking a lot about mushrooms, and we got a little bit of what we wanted to communicate into that book, but, you know, we only had an issue to do it. And so I kept thinking about them and then ended up buying a mushroom identification book, and I spent most of the summer sort of, like, just going to parks and finding mushrooms and see if I could eat them or what they were. I grew some mushrooms in my basement. I've just done a ton of research into mushrooms and the way that they work. And the thing that's interesting about them and the reason that some of this book exists is that they operate on a decentralized network. They very much take care of one another, share nutrients, and mushrooms have no sort of, like, head of the mushroom web, the mycelium web, so to speak. They have no seat of government. They have no seat of, like, power or sort of, like, distribution, but they all take care of one another in this, like, equal way and share nutrients and sort of, like, you know, some types of mushrooms are not living, some are dead, really. They're sort of in this in-between space. And so there's a lot of that in I Breathe the Body, but as it relates to sort of, like, starting to realize that it, you know, there's divisions that are forming within ourselves thanks to social media. Who you are on Twitter is not who you are in real life. It's not one-to-one. And so it kind of has pushed humans to sort of start existing in these, like, liminal spaces like mushrooms. And that was, like, really fascinating to me. And I was like, well, how do I, like, wrap that all up in horror? And interestingly enough, there's, like, a long history of fungal horror that I was not aware of. And then as I started to dig in, I was like, oh, shit, like, there's a rich history here that I can mine.
So just to pivot a little bit, actually, as a quick aside, I want to say that we have I live in rural Washington State, and we have a very strong mushroom harvesting season. There's a lot of, like, oh, morels and other mushrooms. And I have coworkers that are very into it. And one time I asked one of my good coworkers, do you ever think about how mushrooms, how weird they are? Or are you just kind of in this process of, like, I go out, I get them, I eat them, I sell them, whatever. And she was like, I think about how weird they are all the time.
Oh, yeah. That's yeah.
And I was like, huh, it's kind of like communing with the other in a way, you know?
Yeah. And there's a large part of that in the book where it, like I said, as you start to descend down this road, it's like, yeah, we're communing with the other in a big way.
In your newsletter, which I recommend folks subscribe to, you mentioned that Ann Stewart is planning her escape from Silicon Valley in a proverbial sense. What do you feel like you would be escaping from, or where would you be escaping to if you were to speak for yourself?
So I dream of leaving. I live in Vancouver, BC, and I dream of leaving the city almost constantly. But on top of that, you know, my fiance worked in Silicon Valley for a little while, and she was sort of, like, inundated with this, like, excess all the time. And I think what it does to you is it creates a sense that, like, money is the only thing that matters. And a lot of people that I talk to, like, her coworkers and everything, we're always in the state of, like, you know, burnout and had been working 80-hour weeks or whatever, but they were ready to, like, they were like, oh, you know, as soon as I hit this magic number, I'm out of here. As soon as I have this amount of savings, I'm gone. And that was like this complete thing that, like, no matter what level or what position these people were at, they were always talking about how they didn't want to work at this amazing company anymore and they wanted to get the fuck out of there as fast as possible. And, you know, I think it ties into this sort of like burnout culture that we've created where, like, you're supposed to, like, turn your job into your life. Mm. And, like, a lot of people have this, like, exit strategy for, like, what they would do if they had X amount of money and they could just sort of, like, you know, detach from all the things that are their normal responsibilities and kind of go into this completely different lifestyle. And I myself daydream about that a lot. I think that, like, this year in particular has made me quite disillusioned with large cities, in that, like, that, you know, it's supposed to be a community where people take care of one another. And with COVID, you can very clearly see that people are more concerned about themselves and less concerned about, like, taking care of the community. And so, like, for me, I'm just like, I want to, like, pack my shit and move to the country and just sort of, like, detach from a lot of the things that I feel like were the things that I used to define myself. Like, I'm a city guy that, like, loves doing this stupid shit. And now I'm like, I want to leave and live on a farm. and I think that a lot of people go through that. I think that, like, when you get wrapped up in a career that you didn't necessarily want to be doing, I think it can be very easy to sort of have years go by without asking hard questions about, like, is this what I want? And so, back when I was a journalist, a lot of my work was motivated by saving money to go write comics. I always had that in the back of my head, like this emergency exit that was like, if you hate this, if you have a really bad day, you can leave here and it might be hard and it might suck, but you've done this other thing and you can go and you can write comics and it'll be okay. It'll just suck for a really long time.
It'll suck in a different way.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people are sort of seeking an identity and, you know, seeing people on Twitter, you know, get angry over everything or whatever, that's not the way to find yourself, right? And, like,
yeah,
that identity seeking is something a lot, I mean, everybody goes through at some point in their life, not necessarily like in their teens or 20s, but yeah, that's kind of fascinating.
And it factors in, there's some stuff with Anne's character that it factors in as the series progresses, where, like, I really wanted to get into the heart of that disillusionment you have with yourself about, like, who you present yourself to be. Do you ever have this, like, reckoning with, like, how you're outwardly presenting on social media, and then you're like, oh, I'm a fake piece of shit. Like, I don't actually feel that way at all. But now I've put it out into the world, and it sort of creates this, like, disillusionment where you sort of see two versions of yourself. And there's not that very clear sort of, like, distinction between what traits are you and what traits are, like, the projection that you've put out into the world, or vice versa. And, like, there's nothing wrong with having a barrier or boundaries between, like, who you are online and who you are in real life. I think that's healthy. But, you know, I think when I was younger, I definitely was wrapped up more concerned about, like, what people thought of me when I posted a certain thing on Instagram, rather than, like, whether or not, you know, I was taking care of the people in my life or whatever. I don't know. But it creates a weird sense of disillusionment with yourself.
You know, like, in sort of the same vein, I would say, what we wear in fashion also kind of signals to others who we are, and it may not be who we really are. Maybe we really just want to stay at home and sit in a Snuggie or something.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask, you know, I noticed in the first two issues, as we got to read in advance, fashion is quite cool and modern and interesting looking in the book, particularly for, like, Milo, the entitled kid, or Dalton, who somehow reminds me of Batu from Ghost in the Shell. Could you talk a little about, I nailed it. Could you talk a little bit about, like, how you went about kind of creating the fashion sense for these characters?
Yeah. So that came from, again, like, working on Lonely Receiver, I like, I like fashion. I wear a lot of like bright clothes, and I like finding like weird, cool shit that like no one else has. So I wear like old cowboy Wrangler shirts that are like super bright and weird, and like no one else would ever wear them. And they're like, you know, they're in the thrift store for like 8 weeks, and then I come in and buy all of them. Nice. And they're like, why? And so like, I found that like, for me, I think about like, well, like you said, like, what does it say about a person with what they wear? And like for Milo, it was a lot about like making him bright and making him like sort of like radiant compared to some of the other characters who are more like dour, or like, you know, his father wears a three-piece suit, very much like a, you know, a Hannibal style sort of like character where he's very prim and proper. And then you have this kid who's like in the color blocking hoodie, which I literally have one on right now.
Nice.
And I think that you immediately understand the juxtaposition between the two characters at that point. And I think that I came from like a film background, and I think that like a lot of what they teach you is like, you can communicate a lot about a character visually, just through the choices of clothing that they wear. Very similarly, like Ethel and I Breathe the Bot, or fuck, and I'm Dumb by Blood.
Yeah.
Like with the shaved head and the kink shirt and the, you know, the high waisted jeans and the cowboy boots, like, you know who she is the moment you see her.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
that was the sort of stuff that I wanted to communicate with characters, is like, if you can see them in the first scene that they're in and kind of get their vibe, then you've done a good job of sort of like differentiating them. And like, one of the things I do before I even start scripting is I go like, okay, create like a character matrix and sort of go like, this character represents this thing in the story, so they're going to be depicted this way. And I give that to the artist, so they sort of like create these character sketches, but they also have very clear outfit choices in that description. So they will always look different, and there's not going to be a thing where like you get to the third issue and then everyone looks the same, unless that you're doing that on purpose. But yeah, it's very much like a choice. And I really like just like looking at Pinterest of like cool clothes and being like, I want to wear that, so I'll put it on my character.
That's awesome.
So when it comes to good titles, we're always wondering, was this the first try? Did you have any other titles kicking around for this project, or what's the process like for finding a title? Because that's a signifier as much as, you know, fashion and dialogue.
Funnily enough, it comes from being in journalism, sort of like creating titles that have good SEO. It almost comes down to just basically that. Because, you know, my first book was called The Dregs, not very easy to find online. And then my second book was called Come Into Me, and the unholy things that you see.
Oh boy.
When you search that word.
Yeah.
Not great. And so you sort of learn a hard lesson pretty early.
That's funny.
But yeah, I think this book was, at some point it was called The Social Flesh. Then I realized that was a word, or like a phrase that we used in Come Into Me. I was going to name it after mushrooms for a little while, so it was called Amarillia Foxfire for a little while, which I think is still cool, but has that sort of like, because it's related to mushrooms and it's a certain type of mushroom, and it would be difficult to sort of like find, I think. And then it also just made me evoke too much of like Halt and Catch Fire, so I didn't want to go in that direction. It really comes down to like, I usually come up with like a list of like 10 names, and then slowly over the course of time while I'm working on the book, it becomes more and more clear like what title makes the most sense. And with this book, like I said, it's been sitting in my head since like 2017. So I've had plenty of time to sort of like noodle on it and figure out what would work best for it.
So you don't have them up on a board and you're throwing darts and you're like, okay, that's it.
I have a file where I just have like names of stuff sometimes, where sometimes it's like, oh, this pitch doesn't have a name, let's go to the name file. And then I just sort of like, oh, you know what, if I change this word to this word, that will actually suit this story quite perfectly. And It came from Matt Rosenberg, who said, long titles are easier to get wrong, but harder to forget, which I think is interesting. In that, like, he's like, one of the reasons we named Four Kids Walk Into a Bank, that title is, he's like, I worked at a comic book store. 9 times out of 10, people are going to go, I want that Four Kids book, right? And they won't know the rest of it. Or something walks into a bank, and like, it's enough of like a, the margin for error becomes larger or smaller, sorry. So people don't fuck it up. And, you know, you're more likely to get it in someone's hands because they sort of like might not be able to remember the whole thing, but they'll remember enough of it that they can get it.
Yeah. Like their mental Google search has got at least one of those words in their brain.
Yeah. And like, if you look at Rosie's next, creator owned, it's like, what's the furthest place from here? And it's like, yeah, again.
Nice. We actually had Steve Fox on last week to talk about, well, everything he's been doing this year, but also Razor Blades. I was curious, could you talk a little bit about your work at Razor Blades, the horror magazine?
Yeah, so that was a short with Jen and I called Fruiting Bodies. And that was something that Jen and I have been sort of talking a lot about what we want to do after Lonely Receiver. And I think that like the thing that became clear was that like we both really like weird erotic horror. And we came together on this book because we were actually building a pitch for like a new eco horror thing that we're working on that doesn't really have a title yet or anything, but it's gonna be sort of like in that world with those characters that you saw on Razor Blades. And the idea is to create something that is like a little bit like Ursula Le Guin's Left Hand of Darkness, and a little bit like, what compare it to? Something like Jeff Vandermeer, where it's where a lot of the horror is derived from the environment and less of the horror once we are past the Razor Blades thing, which was very much about the horror of the human body, like a lot of my stuff. I'm intrigued in telling stories about like human evolution or humanoid evolution, humanoid sexuality, because, you know, obviously the lines about sexuality have started to blur, and we're looking at that whole spectrum and we're starting to understand more of it. And I think that I really want to tell a story where sexuality isn't something to be feared, but it's actually your source of strength, like against something that is terrifying. So that's sort of like some of that idea came from that. But on the flip side, we had to make it scary and crazy. So we sort of only had 4 pages to sort of do something. So like what was evocative was spore semen.
Right, right. That was such a twisted story.
Yeah, and the like actual work that we want to create afterwards almost is like the opposite of that in many ways, where like I look at that as almost like the event that would begin this sort of series, where it is like this remorse about this experience that you've had with another person where you may have damaged them because you wanted something, and then sort of exploring that and unpacking that, and what does it mean to feel that remorse, and what does it mean to sort of like create some security around your sexuality and forgive yourself, and like I think that that's something that like a lot of young people are looking for, and I know that in my own life journey that would be something that I would have devoured as a young man, because I feel like we have Sunstone and we have a lot of like really racy like comics that are out there, but I still feel like they're sort of like not quite mainstream. And you can see that because like the people who read Sunstone are fucking crazy about Sunstone. They love it. And there's a reason for that, right? It's speaking to a community that no one else is really speaking to in frank and honest terms. And I think that there's like a lot of power to be derived from like reclaiming some things that we're like too afraid to talk about, And yeah, that's, I really want to do a lot more of that with my horror work.
That sounds like the complex kind of topic that you would tackle and do well with, I think.
Thank you.
So stepping away from your creative process just a little bit, can you tell us about some of your other favorite comics this year?
Yeah, I mean, like, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Black Stars. I think that, like, it's so interesting to see Lonnie working on a comic that, like, I'm not involved in, because for so long, he and I have been creating everything together. And so, like, this year was, like, the first sort of moment where we stepped away. And, yeah, I think that book is just masterful in that slow descent into horror. And, like, I was so uninvolved with the process with it, because we usually talk about everything and we sort of, like, siloed off. Like, he didn't know anything about Lonely Receiver. I didn't know anything about Black Stars. And so we were just able to enjoy it as, like, readers. And, man, I love that book. But I know that many may feel I'm contractually obligated to mention my love for that book. So I also love Blue and Green. I thought Blue and Green was fantastic. There's that, like, I wasn't quite ready for how hard it hit me. That, like, lyrical quality of the story was just, like, so wonderful. And because it was made with, like, that jazz framework, like, every time I flipped a page, I was like, I don't know what I'm about to descend into. And I loved that. A Map to the Sun, Sloan Long's graphic novel from First Second. I just devoured it. I think the way that she colors that book, like, with the, I don't know if either of you have read it, but each page, like, the color spreads it into the gutters of the panels and everything. So, like, if you look at the book from, like, a side perspective, like, you see this beautiful, like, rainbow fade on the pages. And I just was like, how has no one done this before? Like, it just looks so beautiful as an object in and of itself. And, like, I'm really attracted to those, like, bright neon colors. So that really spoke to me in a huge way. Department of Truth. I mean, like, holy crap. I read that first issue and I was like, oh my God. It felt like finding an old Vertigo comic.
Yeah, yes.
And like, in the perfect way, right? Like, I just, it was like getting hit with an aluminum baseball bat in the side of the head, where I was like, oh my God. Like, because it also is just like, James sent it to me early and I read it and I was like, is DC gonna get mad at him because, like, the writer of Batman is, like, going for the throat of society right now? Like, I was like, oh God, like, is he gonna be okay? Like, Red Fork, Alex Pakinadel, super good Appalachian horror, just, like, I couldn't put it down. I read the first issue, really liked it, and then I got the trade and sort of just, like, sat down and I was like, I'll just read one more issue. And then I finished it in one sitting and was just sort of, like, floored by it. Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, how good is that?
Quirky fun. For sure.
Yeah, and just having, like, you can just tell they're having a blast, you know, like, which is, and, like, how many stories do you get in each issue as well? Like, it's just absurd. I don't know. Two people at the top of their form just having a blast. And the last one I'll talk about is I read Bloodroot, which is just on Gumroad. Really creepy and atmospheric. There's only two issues out right now. And I really, really enjoyed it. I forget the name of the woman who wrote it. Let me see.
Looks like James Niche and Elise Vermeulen.
Yes, yeah. Fantastic stuff. And yeah, I've been, like, reading tons, and some of the stuff I'm reading I have to, like, keep quiet about because it's a little bit of, like, research.
Yeah, I imagine, you know, being in the industry, do you feel obligated to have to read, like, everything, or do you stick to indies and stay away from, you know, a lot of Marvel or DC just because it's not necessarily in your realm?
I have a weird feeling about it because I don't know if you guys know, but I worked on like the journalism side of comics for a little while, reviewing comics for Bloody Disgusting, and running their comics section when it existed, like back in 2014, 2015. Mm-hmm. And part of that, what I realized was like indie books needed the coverage more than anything, you know, that right. they were just the people who were like nicer and more willing to sort of like go and have long conversations with you, what have you. And it kind of rewired my brain a little bit where I'm like, I can read Sword number one and tweet about it and be like, you got to go get it. But it's like, that doesn't really make it's a drop in the bucket. Right. Whereas like I can read Map to a Sun, and I'm not saying that I hold any real sway or anything. I'm just saying that like, maybe people who've read Lonely Receiver might now read Map to the Sun because they like that book, and I can make that connection, and I can make a smaller creative team like happy or have more of an impact with a book sold. And so like, that's what I try to focus on a lot, is like, how can I read stuff that makes an impact when I say, hey, I really like this, you should go read it. Not that I have any sort of inflated sense of taste or anything like that, but I just think like we owe it to one another to sort of help indie books that need more eyes. So that's typically where I spend most of my reading time in comics. And like, usually what happens is I'll have big two books at this point of the year, a giant stack where I'm like, okay, now I'm gonna read, like, I haven't read X of Swords. Mm-hmm. Right, I read, yeah, Sword because I was like, I can't wait for this fucking thing, so yeah, I have, yeah. But like now I'll wade into that, right? Because it's been piling up and I'm like, okay. And like, you know, Immortal Hulk I keep up on because, sure, I can't stop.
it's so like, it's almost revolutionary in its approach. Yeah. It's pretty amazing. Yeah.
Oh, guys, I could talk for 2 hours about it.
Speaking of getting more eyes on things, can you give us a teaser of some things to come in 2021? And you can be as obtuse as you'd like.
Okay, so we have I Breathe the Body, which is like weird social Cronenbergian horror with a dash of Clive Barker that, you know, if you love Lonely Receiver, you'll like that. We've got more Undone by Blood that will start in March, and it's a very different type of story than the first story. Still very evocative of old school Westerns, but this one's a heist story. On top of that, I have my first big two book that I'm writing by myself. I think it might get announced in the next couple weeks, but I'm unclear because lots of stuff is getting shuffled around due to COVID. I will say this, it's an eco horror book. It's something that like I've been dying to do, and have been given like an opportunity and a big space to do something really cool and impactful. And Immortal Hulk has been like my North Star on this.
Ooh. Wait, yeah, don't say so anything, but I'm going to say Zach Thompson doing a Poison Ivy book, but in the vein of Immortal Hulk. I'm just going to say that. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
And then on top of that, I have a new book with Hayden Sherman that is like currently sort of finding a home, and that's like it's going to be like a full on like weird fiction tour de force that we're sort of like, we're calling like a Cronenbergian haunted house meets House of Leaves.
Oh, interesting. No.
Yeah. No, in a good way.
Oh, okay. I was worried.
Like, it's like SEO perfected to target me.
Oh, nice. I like that sense.
We are going to create something that can be read in different orders with multiple stories, multiple different types of art. Hayden and I met because we worked on Angel together and just sort of like completely hit it off. And because of COVID, that book, we were slated to do 12 issues. We got knocked down to 3. So we were like, well, how do we like take that 9 issues of like energy that we still have together and like do something fucking crazy and big? And we found it, and there's currently like two publishers that are like fighting over it, which is nice.
Ooh, that's exciting. A
nice feeling.
Yeah.
I've never been in that situation. So I'm like just sitting back, like with my fingers tented, being like, yes.
That's cool.
Yeah. So keep them busy.
Nice. Oh, yeah. So busy.
And Lonnie and I have a new book with Peter Kowalski that has found a home, and we will be writing right after Undone by Blood. And like, we're going fucking crazy on that one too.
Nice. Could we expect that in the end of 2021?
I think, yeah. I mean, like, what we're probably looking at is like a September, October at this point. Because like the whole book is outlined, but there hasn't been an issue written because essentially it was like greenlit immediately after Undone by Blood, and then Undone by Blood happened to get picked up for a second arc, and we were like not prepared.
Right.
And like, cause it just like, you know, when you, this year has been so wild that I think like we both just made our peace with the fact that like we got five issues and that was awesome. And then because of everything with the option, we sort of had to like reorganize and figure out our plans, because like now that he and I have taken on more solo work, we really only have the bandwidth to write one book together at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a good problem to have.
Of course. Yeah. Wow. Jeez, you're a busy dude. In our last segment, Off Topic Top Shelf, we're going to ask you what you're into right now that's not comics related.
I just watched Bong Joon-ho's Memories of Murder for the first time. It rocked me.
Yes.
Oh, man, yeah.
It's good.
It speaks to the themes that I love and those sorts of stories where, you know, that just, like, gut punch of an ending that... I don't know. It's going to be with me for a long time. So now my new mission is to basically watch all of Bong Joon-ho's movies over the course of my Christmas break. I've been playing Symphony of the Night again, just because I fucking love that game. And I thought I was good at it. And then I got to the Upside Down Castle, and now I'm getting my ass kicked and questioning my life choices. I watch a lot of terrible films and a lot of really good ones. I try to like keep my palate balanced. So I watched Zardoz and Ishtar this week.
Okay.
It's been a real weird one.
Yeah, that's a journey.
Okay. Yeah, and Zardoz was, like, just awful, like, incomprehensible, like, just, I don't know. I mean, like, I admire it because it's, like, knowing what I know about Sean Connery, you're like, why did he agree to be in this movie?
Yeah, yeah.
And then Ishtar is terrible. I wouldn't wish it upon my worst enemy. It was, like, a long gestating joke between a couple friends and I, and we have this, like, digital movie night, and he, like, forced it on us. And it was not fun.
Or like a watch party?
Yeah. Are you guys aware of Ishtar at all?
I don't think so. Ishtar.
It's Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty go to the Middle East as singers, and they're basically like white saviors that are going to like...
Oh, no.
Oh, this looks bad.
Yeah, it's terrible.
It does.
Wow.
It's so much worse than you could ever expect. Yeah, it's
Tootsie, but in the Middle East.
Yeah, it's bad. And they solve all the problems in the Middle East. No problem.
All problems.
Wow. Got him in one.
Just took two white dudes.
Oh, good lord.
Well, Zach Thompson, thank you so much for being on. This was a blast.
Thank you for having me. This is always great.